David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 396. I'm your host, Steve Raker, thought broadcasting, boosted by Cerebro, from the comic book Bunker, but by the time you hear this, I'll be camping deep in the 100-acre wood of the Adirondacks, looking for hidden cities, lost talismans, items of power, portals, and the guardians that protect them. It'll be good to get away. But consider this, I could have left you with an LMD host, but I got you, mighty Marvelite. Marvel Noise is the semi-monthly Marvel-centric podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. You can find, listen to, stream, and download episodes past and present over on marvelnoise.com. And get new episode announcements, give us feedback, see images and cover galleries on our Facebook and Twitter pages. You can find other fine podcasts from our supreme intelligence, Derek Coward, and his Deliberate Noise Network that hosts us, and also hosts Indie Comic Book Noise, our sister show where we talk indie comics. Item, the Baltimore Comic Con is coming in October. They're a longtime friend of this podcast. The Baltimore Comic Con is a comics-focused show with what's become an amazing list of creator guests. It's a giant-size artist's alley, true believers, and it's back at the Baltimore Convention Center in the Inner Harbor Tourist Trap Zone of Baltimore on October 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. See the great guest list and get tickets and other information at BaltimoreComicCon.com. See you in Baltimore. I'll be there as my buddy Jim Whiting's booth babe. Come find us if you dare. Good Halloween monster stuff at Jim's table for you to check out, too. Twill be the season. So, you know the drill by now. Andrew the L.A. Rabbit and WWX Kevin will be on in a few for a Bronze Age binge and to share a recent read. But before that, it's customary for the host to recommend or review a book or two. So, I've got one book that fell short of being a satisfactory read and one that was... well, pretty superficial, but fun if you just go along for the ride. And it's a long one before all said and done. The ride. Not my review. First up is Captain America, Symbol of Truth, number 3. This is the Sam Wilson Falk cap. Written by Tochi Onibuchi, with art by Arby Silva and Zay Carlos. And the art is plenty fine, but the pacing of the book... is what left me less than fulfilled after I read it. The cover is interesting enough. It promotes a confrontation with Dr. Doom. Cap is fighting his way through a mob of goons. But inside, Cap and Deadpool are already captured and in shackles and being brought before Doom, who pretty much just warns them in postures, and then Cap is released. So there was no confrontation, there was no fighting his way out through a mob of goons or anything like that. Then Cap makes a Zoom call to Wakanda to ask for help because the case he's on is about vibranium smuggling happening, but they decline and posture. And that's that confrontation. And Cap has a partner, this new Falcon, old... decked out in green like the original Falcon's costume was, although it's very dissimilar, it's more like armor, but he gets into trouble. But that's the issue. There's no action, both confrontations end in a whimper. I don't know, I promised I'd give this whole first arc a go after not feeling it with the first issue, so I'll stick with it for now. The other Cap book isn't much better, so... I'll keep trying. Amazing Spider-Man number 6 of the current series also turns out to be, if you're using the legacy numbering, issue number 900. you know, if you trust what they're telling you. Under a Romita Jr. Scott Hanna Sinister 7 cover, with Spidey front and center and a slew of his greatest foes that make up the Sinister Six all around him, this issue features a 70-page lead story written by Zeb Wells with art by Ed McGuinness and inks by Mark Morales, McGuinness, Rathburn, and Von Grawbadger. I'm not going to spoil what the story is at the heart, but basically Doc Ock's animated arms come looking for Spider-Man to help rescue Doc Ock and the other members of the original Sinister Six. It's a action-packed tale that also involves the Super Adaptoid and the Living Brain. And I'll end it with that, just to tease you with at least the characters who are involved. It's big, dumb, done-in-one fun. And 11 pages of backups follow, because, I mean, it is an anniversary issue after all. There's a 5-page backup written by Daniel Kibblesmith with art by David Lopez that is really silly. Peter's got late fees at the library because, you know, he's always late and he's always busy and those books pile up. Hard to get him back where you got him from, I guess. Then there's a 4-page Jeff Loveness Todd Nauck backup, which is basically a 4-page ad for Jimmy Kimmel, also a Disney ABC show. Then the backups end with a 2-page Dan Slott, Marcos Martin spread that celebrates the old Parker luck and associated pressure. And that was fun. It's not a bad issue overall, though. And it's almost out of the current series continuity, which is a good thing. As promised, I've got WWX Kevin and Andrew the LA Rabbit here in the bunker. This episode's Bronze Age binge takes us way back to two issues that, although 3 years apart in 1973 and 1976, are connected by writer Steve Gerber, The Legacy of the Molecule Man, and The Man-Thing. The first being Marvel 2-in-1 number 1 from 1973, and the second is Iron Man Annual number 3 from 1976.
Why is Man-Thing brown?
I have actually never read either of these. I came to the 2-in-1 series pretty late in the run, so it was kind of fascinating to be like, whoa, that's right, all these things started way back when, you know. I think of it more with a higher cover price, Super Steve.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun to look back at these issues that came just before, you know, when the reprinted books that we were reading in the 70s and early 80s were mostly from the Silver Age. And then we were getting a, you know, good, healthy dose of the current comics. But, like, there was this funny little era in the sort of 72 to 3 to around 75 or 6 or so, that there are some holes in my reading and in what had been reprinted back in the day. So definitely fodder for finding some sleeper issues and funny connections and interesting first appearances and concepts that have been developed over the decades that it's like, oh, here's where they came from?
So, I mean, that would have been a good joke there. You said some sleeper issues. And if I didn't like the issues, I could say, oh, those were sleepers, all right.
When Marvel 2-in-1, number 1, hit the shelves in 73, it was replacing Marvel Feature that had run for 12 issues. 3 issues of The Defenders in Marvel Feature. Then there were 7 issues, I think, of Ant-Man. And then the last 2 issues were The Thing and, I think it was The Hulk was the first one, and Iron Man was the second one. So with that as kind of the tryout for The Thing being the other team-up guy, the title morphed into 2-in-1.
Yeah, he's a good team up guy.
Two for the price of one.
Written by Steve Gerber with art by Gil Kane and Joe Sinnott, who looks like he had a tough time with Gil Kane.
I like Gil Kane and Joe Sinnott a lot, but this is not my thing. I guess I always think of like Ron Wilson with the
Yeah.
And this is not Ron. Like I said, Gil Kane and Joe Sinnott, two Hall of Fame artists. So it's just weird that this is like their thing. And I'm like, where's Ron?
The premise here is, well, it's solid, right? The Thing takes a bus to Florida to go have a word with the Man Thing about using his name. Nobody steals the Thing's glory.
Wow, and nowadays he would just leap on the internet and get all raged up, I guess.
Yeah,
Shades of Power Man fighting Luke Cage. Yeah, fighting.
Totally. Like he's all Luke Cage-ing out here.
Like, it ain't bad enough. Page,
I'm like, wild.
It's not bad enough just being the Thing. This bug-eyed mudball's got to come along and rip off my name, too. And he doesn't care how many shopkeepers or bus patrons or drivers he's got to intimidate to, like, get this done.
He's kind of a jerk, I say.
I know.
Like, regular citizens getting menaced by this guy.
This
threat or menace?
This portrayal doesn't exactly support the, oh, the Thing is the other hero who gets along with everybody in the Marvel Universe and should get a team-up book, right? I mean... So, meanwhile, the Molecule Man is lying on his deathbed in another dimension, in exile, for 10 years of print comics, since Fantastic Four number 20, his first appearance, in fact. Because at the end of that, the Watcher sent him to a dimension where time would go faster and he would age quick and die.
Wait, are you saying the Watcher interfered?
He didn't just interfere, he sent him to his death. Like,
yeah, like, I thought, there's going to be another crossover or something, right? Or,
For me, this is where, like, then I was like, oh yeah, this is Gil Kane. Okay.
Yeah, right.
These pages kind of brought it back. But I like how Molecule Man Jr. is super ripped. Like, he's hitting the gym.
I mean, the Molecule Man does die exactly as this is Owen Reese. This is the Molecule Man. He dies just as the Watcher intended him to, but because he's on this in this other dimension where time moves faster, he's been able to raise an adult son who then vows to carry out his vengeance on the Fantastic Four and becomes the new Molecule Man and escapes. And he comments that his simple robes have been transformed to a far more fearsome manner of garb, but I don't know if the new costume is working for me.
I'd be pretty afraid if that guy showed up in front of me, Steve. That's all I'm saying.
My simple robes, and I'm like, dude, you're like naked.
So he's going to seek out the Thing first, thinking that he's got the most cosmic ray energy stored up in him because he's, you know, a grotesque monster. So he'd be a good beacon. So he keys in on the Thing. And so the Molecule Man here materializes in the Everglades, drawn towards the Thing's location, and instead encounters, but kind of brushes off the Man Thing.
Well, also, he's figured out the Owen, before he kicked the bucket, figured out how to overcome his one weakness, and that is to make it so that he can affect organic molecules now, which sounds like a pretty big power-up. You know, although I will say, I feel like the Man Thing under this team has some size discrepancies. Like, seems to get bigger or smaller, depending on where he's at.
The Thing comes along looking for the Man Thing to, you know, tell him what's what, and instead finds the Molecule Man.
Of course.
So they fight, and the Man Thing appears and helps. So the Molecule Man just depowers them both and changes them back into Ben Grimm and Ted Salas.
Wow. Reed should have went after this guy.
And as proves my theory, the Thing really loves, Ben Grimm loves being the Thing. He always fakes like he doesn't want to be, but every time they trade him back, he's working so hard to become the Thing again. He should just be like, I like being the Thing, okay? I know I'm not supposed to, but I don't like being Ben Grimm. It's terrible now.
I think it's kind of cool how Ted Salas doesn't remember anything of being the Man-Thing. His last memory is, you know, like falling into the swamp, running from his ex-wife and the, well, his wife at the time, right? And those agents that she sicked on him. And then he has the brief memory of, like, this weird enchanted castle land, because remember in that story we read when he was in that other dimension with Jennifer Kale and the wizard with the pointy hat and everything? He got turned back into Ted Salas and, like, you know, tempted with the idea of being human again briefly, but he ended up making the same choice that the Thing always makes and becoming Man-Thing again. But it's funny that he also remembers that, but I guess that's what we get when the writer Steve Gerber, who wrote those stories.
And Molecule Man's pretty cool because he gives Ted his clothes back, but poor Ben has to wear his Thing outfit, which is underwear.
He even has his, like, you know, hiking socks and his, like, wool socks and everything. It's like, oh, Man Thing has wool socks on under there somewhere. The nexus of all realities in the swamp won't allow Molecule Man to teleport away. So he kind of walks to the nearest town, good old Citrusville, and starts ripping up the streets and horrifically turns a dude into Reed Richards and then stretches him apart and just kills him.
That is pretty bleak.
Ben and Ted sound too noble in their human forms with all, you know, the ability to verbally criticize the Molecule Man the whole time. So Molecule Man changes them back into monsters and makes them fight each other.
Well, I mean, it's not a Marvel comic unless the heroes fight at some point in the dang thing, Steve.
I like how the Thing just punches right through the Man Thing, and it's just like, well, he's not holding back.
He ends up with a fistful of Man Thing muck that he decides to just, like, throw, like a monkey throwing his poop at the Molecule Man, and instead of hitting the Molecule Man in the face like he was hoping, just like every monkey throwing his poop hopes, instead he hits the wand, and, you know, the properties of the Nexus swamp goop manage to knock it from his hand and wrest control of the wand from the Molecule Man.
Oh, cruel fate.
Yep. So
see, if he had come to the future, Steve, he'd know to have those little wrist holders like Nintendo gives you for their things, so you don't lose your controller.
Well, eventually, thanks to Jim Shooter and the Superhero Secret Wars, he would learn that the magic was inside of him, and it was never in the wand at all. But here, it's completely the opposite scenario here, because without the wand, he rapidly ages and turns to dust before he can even reach the wand on the ground.
The magic was inside him all along.
Ben kind
of... No, Steve, it's not the size of the wand, but the magic that's in it, as they used to say.
The Thing kind of shrugs his shoulders at the whole deal. Oh, that kind of sucks. And then smartly tries to use the wand himself to change him and the Man Thing back human. When that doesn't work, he turns around and gives Molecules Man's wand to a kid as a toy. Here you go.
Yeah, see, he really didn't want to change back, so that's why he had to quickly give it away, Steve, because then it would turn out that he really wasn't trying that right, hard to change right. himself back.
You didn't see that his fingers were crossed.
That was a close one.
So, I mean, that's a really weird sequel to the Molecule Man's first and only appearance before that. 10 years later, right? I mean, I was shocked. And the Molecule Man is dead, and it's his son here that carried on, and then his son that died. Or did he? So,
well, it also seems like a weird way to kick off. Like, I don't know if how the people felt like, oh, I got to get on this 2-in-1 title. This is some really hep stuff, but I guess the thing's charisma can carry through the day.
The next issue with Namor has Wundar, the Superman analog that became the Aquarian, and Namorita and Namor and the Thing. There's some good issues there. We should come back to that well at some point. But first, fast forward ahead 3 years to the winter of 1976 and Iron Man Annual number 3, also written by Steve Gerber, this time with art by Sal Buscema and Jack Abel, who I think did some really nice inks whenever there was like a close-up of the Man Thing. So he was doing all of the shading of the tubers coming off of his face and everything. I was really blown away by some of that, because I'm used to the lighter Abel inks that we see a lot in the further away shots, you know, where he doesn't spot a lot of heavy blacks on his pages. But those close-ups, whenever you got like close to the Man Thing's eyes and stuff, he really noodled away. In this issue, Tony Stark is in the Everglades outside Citrusville, agreeing to bankroll reconstruction of Omegaville, which was a self-sustaining town project that was destroyed in Giant Size Man Thing number 1. And speaking of the Man Thing, he's watching three kids engaged in dramatic pretend play as superheroes on the bank of the swamp. There's Spider-Boy, Iron Girl, and the villain, a caped redhead with a wand.
What?
It's the kid that the Thing gave Molecule Man's wand to, just a little more grown up.
Yeah, I didn't like the kid's name, by the way. That freaked me out a little bit, Steve.
I like how the Man Thing's walking away after, like, the Hulk down the street.
Yep. You hear the sad music playing.
Exactly.
Iron Girl knocks Molecule Man's wand out of the boy's hand and into the water. And he's like, the Thing gave me that. So Iron Girl has to go to retrieve it, and then ends up needing to be saved from an alligator by the Man Thing.
And we're doing the second person thing where you're kind of in the shoes of the Man Thing a little bit, and he doesn't really know why he does things and just sort of bumbles around like Mr. Magoo.
Iron Girl then runs right into a quicksand-like swamp pool and drowns with the wand in her hand. And the other two kids rightly freak out and split.
I have to say, Steve, my childhood made me vastly overestimate the dangers and rapidity of quicksand.
Absolutely.
It seemed like every cartoon in the pit was quicksand everywhere, but you would think it was like the third leading cause of death in the 70s.
Totally.
I
mean, didn't like you spend time like working out how you were going to survive quicksand if you got in it? Like, okay, oh,
Yeah, we all knew you don't move, you don't struggle. Like,
you try to get sideways, you try to so that you're more buoyant, you know?
Slow. Yeah, I mean, didn't know anything about CPR or anything, but I was well prepared for the millions of quicksand pits that were just around every corner.
So true. Well, weeks pass since the little girl drowns. The funeral happens. And I mean, Gerber's caption boxes are great. Like, the beatings happen to the kids for allowing it to happen and everything.
Wow.
And Omegaville is well under construction now. So Iron Man's around patrolling, keeping an eye on things, the project. And he starts experiencing weird stuff. There's these floating, pointy mines that shoot thorns at him and then turn into smiley faces in the air. And he starts getting a talking to from some of the townspeople, and then all of a sudden he and one of the townspeople get shot up into the air, and Tony uses his jet boots to land softly, but the other dude just lands and cracks his neck and dies.
Hey, to be fair, he threw a bunch of, I don't know, mud, feces, something at Iron Man right before, so not the most sympathetic guy in the world. Also not the smartest. Like, the guy's in an iron suit. Like, maybe you don't hurl your poop at him.
But Iron Man, or at least Tony, pokes around and learns of the whole Molecule Man incident here from a few years ago. And figures, like, something's up here related to that. When Chapter 2 starts, and I gotta admit, I love going back to giant size issues and annuals from both of the big two in the 70s and early 80s when they would have chapter breaks.
For the dialogue, Steve, do we think people talked like he always has weird slang, and like Gerber wasn't like an old dude in the 70s, but the slang always feels weird to me.
Yep. Knowing that he was so satirical and I wonder what is just him being sarcastic versus him being Chris Claremont, but right before Chris Claremont. I don't know. Maybe there's something about Man-Thing comics, because that's where Claremont did it a lot, too. So when Chapter 2 opens, Iron Girl is seen rising from the radioactive sinkhole. Yes, it's radioactive. In a nod to continuity, it's said that it's the same pit of radioactive quicksand that once formed the Glob, a swamp creature that predated the Man-Thing, who first appeared in Hulk 121 in 1969, created by Roy Thomas and Herb Trimpe, but was an obvious and admitted ripoff of the Heap. But so she comes out of this same pit with the radioactive goo having mixed with the whatever consciousness was left of the Molecule Man's son in the wand, and this little girl now is all Molecule Man'd up. She's not the Molecule Man, she's not the Iron Girl kid, she's like an amalgamation of the two.
Once you get those lines on your face, look out.
The pointy lips. Did he call them the bear trap lips or something like that, Gerber did? That was a good description.
They're almost like steel teeth or something. Like, not Jaws.
Yeah, it was Jaws from the Bond
movies.
Yeah,
it was Jaws, okay.
So, she turns a log into a jet-powered bicycle and goes flying home to her mother, who's rightfully horrified.
Why are you wearing those clothes?
And the Man-Thing follows, but, you know, slowly. And when he crosses the street, gets hit by Tony's limo.
Oh, geez.
And Tony's like, oh, it's on, right? Like, everybody's got it out for the Man-Thing.
Well, you know, Tony keeps, like, extra 10,000. This isn't the first innocent bystander they've run over. He usually just keeps a bunch of cash.
Oh,
like,
not again.
Okay, quick. Get him to sign the paperwork, hand him some cash, I'll give him an autograph, we'll be on our way.
Bascom, you're the worst show forever. So it's Iron Man versus, using his words, a molding smelly marshmallow.
And then the Man-Thing gets run through again. Maybe it's the same hole.
It's his weak spot.
Yes.
So Iron Man freezes the Man-Thing when he realizes he can't physically affect him otherwise, and drops him back in a swamp like an ice cube in a bowl of soup. And the Molecule Man girl, whatever she is, here we go with the pronouns, turns her house into a castle and her mom into like a little rag doll.
I thought that was a commentary on modern toy collecting, Steve.
Made me think of the old Twilight Zone. It's really good you did that, Anthony. It's really good you
wished him into the cornfield.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one. But Iron Girl is still conscious inside this amalgamated body and punches herself in the face a few times, like whap, whap, whap. Iron Man confronts them, but Iron Girl won't let the Molecule Man hurt him because he's her favorite hero. So they flee instead. Now, in Chapter 3, the Molecule Man reappears in the swamp outside the Omegaville project. So Iron Man confronts him again, and this time Iron Girl's consciousness seems to be completely suppressed, wiped out. But not so wiped out to not feel fear when the Man-Thing all of a sudden appears and grabs her wand hand. I wonder if...
Finally, he can burn something.
I like how it goes from, like, evil sneering to, like, evil afraid sneering, but with the the jaws, teeth, and the lines on her face and everything.
Because nobody does evil eyebrows like Sal Buscema, right? And even though the Man-Thing, you know, his touch is burning, you think his hand is still cold from being ice? These are the weird things I think of when I'm reading. But so the wand falls from her hand, and everything and everybody is returned to normal. But then Gerber, to the reader, says, all in all, a rather satisfying way to end this tale, save that neither of the exigencies of comic book publishing nor the existential circumstances will allow us to such tidy a conclusion. We've still 4 pages left to fill. So the wand bounces in the grass where a snake comes by and snaps at it, strikes it, and now it's Molecule Snake Man.
4 pages to fill. Steve, that means it's time for cutaways and pinups is what that means. Come on. I mean, that's an annual staple. Right? You know, we need a shot of the Stark hangar. You know, maybe a guest pinup by Kirby of Happy Hogan or something.
Yeah, that's the problem. Iron Man's cast and Rogues Gallery is so poor. Who wants a bunch of Mighty Marvel masterworks of that bunch? So Radioactive Molecule Snake Man here gets blasted a few times in the face by Iron Man, who then grabs the wand. The snake slithers away with a great story to tell, I would think. But Iron Man then, he starts getting Molecule Manny.
On his armor.
Yep. And Man-Thing then takes the wand from him just in time. And then it's like, good luck to the Molecule Man trying to find a consciousness in that Man-Thing muck body to take over. So it's basically done.
Yeah, I don't understand how a snake has more of a mind. Like, this guy notices fear and things happening and moves towards it and everything. I don't think snakes have, like, super complicated brains and reasoning. What are we saying here, Steve?
I don't know, but Iron Man definitely needs a Coke. Or some Coke. He's hurting. At the end, Man-Thing goes lumbering off with the wand in hand. And Iron Man is just, like, on his knees, exhausted, just thinking to himself that he isn't really sure what just happened there. Like, did Steve Gerber just write a story? I'm so confused.
I'm not sure what he has to... Like, is there a lesson that we're supposed to take? Like, I get the Gerber ones where there's some social message, but I didn't feel there was a lot of commentary for me to ponder after this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's his first meeting with the Man Thing, so it's, is this thing conscious or not conscious? And then this other character dying after they're tormenting this child, and the highs and lows of the whole thing? I don't know.
Anyway. Maybe it's about urban development. It should have stayed Citrusville and never become Omegaville.
So later they'll go on to say that the Molecule Man's consciousness was transformed or transported into the wand just before he died when he got old in the Marvel 2-in-1 issue. And that's why it was in the wand for the, you know, it to get reactivated by the catalyst of that radioactive quicksand there. So from then on, the Molecule Man's consciousness is like in the wand, and when people come across the wand, they get turned into the Molecule Man, like that really memorable George Perez, Joe Sinnott drawn two-parter in the Fantastic Four, right? When Reed Richards turns into the Molecule Man and the building is walking around and people are like falling out of windows on it and stuff. But then, I don't know if it happened before the Secret Wars in the 80s or if it was then, but they tied the power of the Molecule Man. I think it was before that. Maybe there was a Captain America annual or something, but somehow there was a connection to the Cosmic Cube. And they said that the Cosmic Cube's power was part of what Molecule Man first tapped into when he became the Molecule Man, and that he is unfinished, unrefined power that would have been eventually a whole Cosmic Cube. But then there was this whole thing of the Beyonders and Shooter in Secret Wars making it not the wand and bringing back Owen Reese as the as the Molecule Man. The Beyonder brought him back. It's not his son. And something about a pinprick in the universes when the Molecule Man pulled power from their universe when he first became the Molecule Man in FF20, but then that pinprick hole was left as a portal, and that's how the Beyonder came through to do the Secret Wars thing. But then Busick and Perez would retcon that and make it be something else. And I mean, the Molecule Man's origin has been reconfigured over and over again. It's quite remarkable, actually.
See, I thought it was the Secret Wars thing was, holy crap, we got to sell a bunch of Mattel toys.
Yep. What's an easy face paint? We need a big
punch up to segment that. We got to shift an awful lot of Baron Zemo figures. Yeah. And we don't think Kevin's buying them yet, so we need to get that out there.
All right. Before we break this party up, who's got a recent read? Anybody got a recent read?
Well, I got a recent read.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I didn't read the previous Captain America title. Now there's two Captain America titles.
Yep, that's what you get. That's your punishment.
I know. You're like, well, look at this. So,
do you like either of them?
I bought Sentinel of Liberty, that one. Is that one of the ones you're talking about?
It's funny, we bought the same one. First, I listened to podcasts and other people to see what they thought. And then I thought, well, I might as well go with the Valiant Comics Harbinger creative team that's on Captain America Sentinel of Liberty.
Huh.
See, I know them as the Penguins of Madagascar comic book team.
Oh, I guess you could also know them as the, what was that, motorcycle DC series? They also did that one, didn't they?
They've been around for a good 9 or 10 years.
Yeah,
they're just coming in. But yeah, they started with like their own books, and then they had a few, like I think it was Ape that did the Penguins book, or one of those smaller presses, and then they got into Marvel and DC now. It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Now it seems like they're the regular team-up creative team like DNA used to be.
Who are they?
Kelly and Lansig.
There you go.
And we have the artist from, who I know of as the Captain Marvel artist from the recent series, the Carmen Carnero. Andrew, you'll want to announce a letter.
I like how the artist goes from captain to captain.
Well, you got to stay in the thing. Well, it's VC's Joe Caramagna and Nolan Woodard on colors. And I think I got the plain Jane cover. I don't know. But, you know, it's a number one from Marvel, so there might be a variant or two. I don't know. I'm sure Kevin got the Peach Momoko one.
No, I got
Geisha Girls and Captain America.
I mean, that'd be interesting. But maybe it's just a headshot of Captain America.
With a lot of lotus, with a big lotus petal behind him.
Jeez. Your big Baron Zemo head behind him. Red Skull, too. No, maybe that's... what's his name? No, they had some variant covers that were becoming rather plain for a while. I mean, when you're turning out so many variant covers, like sometimes it was just a headshot, and I'm like, that's kind of boring to me. Unless you're like a massive superstar and adding something, but it's still restrictive, right? So yeah, I just got the regular Captain America cover where he's just throwing a shield.
Mighty Shield, Kevin. Mighty Shield.
Oh, that's right. And then all evil is yielding.
Well, it's fun. They put a little bit of... I think you'd have to have the modern coloring kind of... Because there is a reflection, but they still keep the colors over the shield, too. Which was nice.
Yeah, yeah. There's also some shield business in here, too. Which I'm not sure 100% how that will... play out. Like maybe there'll be some crazy thing that you don't want to see happen, I guess. I don't know.
I hope they don't sink the helicarrier again.
Now he'll lose his shield in the sea and they'll have to use a hologram one.
Bubblegum colored.
If there was anything that reminded me of another run, I would probably say it would be like that beginning of Mark Waid's run, like that type of thing where he needs to reconnect with his humanity. And then he's like, well, what's it feel like being an average Joe? And I'm like, oh no, please don't say he's going to go to the NASCAR racetrack or something. But I guess his old apartment is still around. So they're like, oh, who would want to live in that rat's nest? And then the guy's like, literally, that's where I put the rats.
Oh.
So you have a lot of like montage things here too, like, oh, this is Captain America, this is who he fights, this is who he is, type of thing. Apparently he runs around with the shield too. Like, that's a little strange, but, I mean, you do you, I guess, you know?
It's a first issue, so they gotta try to establish everything, right? Is there any conflict action other than him just, like, running around on patrol, or...?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's, like, in the second half, because there's a lot you get to set up his cast, and... Well, and they remember, you know, Cap just didn't, like, take paychecks from Nick Fury all the time. Like he was involved in other things, so they have him here trying to draw on an iPad, and they have a nude model that he's supposed to be drawing here.
Ooh, Diamondback.
Yeah, if only.
It felt to me a little bit like they were just trying to jam in a lot of stuff from his past, him being a comic book artist. There's a crack about Dimension Z. Felt a little bit like, hey, we did our homework. We're going to put all these touchstones in. That didn't work so much for me. I mean, I get why you do that, but for me, it felt a little bit like, okay, we're going to jam his Wikipedia over 10, 15 pages of it. And you know, Andy, he's dumb and just wants the punch up faster.
See, if this would have been just a punch up, I probably would have been less interested.
Well, like,
I
want to
see you put some
story in before you get to your punch up. So, I'm out. The redesign of the destroyer was not to my liking at all, as well.
I thought it was so funny when you get to that Thunderbolts reference where he's just like, yeah, you know, Roger Aubrey as the Mighty Destroyer. I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, why would you reference that? It was just funny.
The World War II Destroyer outfit, I think, is so iconic and classic. And I did not think, I don't know if this particular version had been seen before, but you guys know the one I'm talking about. I mean, it's way back from before Marvel was Marvel.
Yeah.
And it was that crazy kind of like skull and like kind of the jackety thing. And then he also has a skull on his face.
Yep.
And this one looks more like kind of those tactical suits with a bunch of smaller skulls as like highlights. I'm like, no way. What was fun was kind of the over the topness of the one and the kind of golden age design to it, but was still kind of creepy. I don't know. And look, hey, everybody's got to redesign stuff and you can't keep it all the same. But that was one where I'm like, I like the other one. But are you familiar with this redesign, Kevin? Am I missing out on this one?
Well, considering I didn't, like, I've been in and out of Captain America, I would guess that this is a new one, but I can't say for sure. But I think this was good enough. I picked up the second issue today. I know it's already been out, but I thought, oh, I'll give it a second issue. You know, I've enjoyed some long runs of Captain America.
Hey, one out of two ain't bad.
Yeah, I'm on the fence. I got the first issue and wasn't blown away. And similar to the other Captain America. I get the idea of having the two titles. I'm all for that. I get the idea of having the two Captain Americas. I'm all for that. But so far, I guess it's also in that problem that you're on the first act of each of their first arcs, right? So, like, you kind of gotta let them breathe a little bit. So, hopefully by issue 9 or 10, we'll get an idea of whether these things are, you know, you like what they're doing here or not.
I mean, it certainly wasn't one of those explosive intros like the one Ed Brubaker and Epting came onto the book. Like, I was just like, they're like, wow.
I've read some Captain America 2, at least a Captain America themed issue in Avengers Forever number 7, which is from Jason Aaron and Aaron Cooter.
Still going,
and now it sort of makes sense of what its purpose is as a title here. It is keeping the interdimensional, multiversal Masters of Evil storyline going, while the regular title does other stuff, basically. So you've got...
Well, if the title's correct, Steve, can't they never cancel it?
Yeah. But you've got the Ghost Rider and Ant-Man and Deathlok on their quest across the multiverse, which a little more light gets shed on what the status of that is and what they're up to, which is good because it keeps you understanding what's happening, because each issue is sort of pulling away and doing a different take. Like, the past few have been done in one type issues. Like, this one is a prison planet where all of these multiversal Steve Rogerses are all being held. So every inmate is Steve Rogers of a different universe.
What's the plural? Is it Steve Roger-I?
Right. And ultimately, you know, they find their spirit, right? As Steve Rogers always will. But it's a tight little issue, well drawn, and it goes from point A to point Z in, at a good pace. It had that Captain America taste to it, even though it was kind of more of a legacy type issue.
I hear he can do it all day, Steve.
Hmm. That's what she said. All right, Andrew.
All right, is it my turn?
It is.
Okay. Longtime listeners know Andy in a overcome of nostalgia, which is all that ever motivates me anymore, picked up his subscription to the new Hulk series that I've been enjoying.
Oh.
So issue 7 rolled in the door. And, you know, I really liked the first 6 issues. It was the crazy The Hulk engine where they were torturing the Hulk with increasingly harder bad guys that would power the Hulk's the Hulk body. It was very like, I'm not going to say I understand it or can explain it, but I really had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was big, bombastic Ryan Ottley, like just doing like a 50-foot tall classic Wolverine, like, you know, the Hulk version of Galactus, like just every kind of big punch up dumb stuff that Andy likes.
And the Hulk being a ship that's piloted was clever and comic booky, right?
Yeah, and like a Betty AI that goes crazy and takes over, and just it feels like there's more there, but when you think about it, you're like, actually, I don't think there's that much more there. It's just fun, crazy comic booking. So, you know, but it just dawned on me that there's some real problems. Okay, they want to resurrect the subscription model, but it's completely hash. Like, not only does the post office fold, spindle, and mutilate your copies, fine, whatever. So I get number 7, and I had forgotten, like, I had to go back to 6 and forgot where it was, because 7 is the middle of the Banner of War crossover series. So imagine you're someone who gets your books via subscription. You're never going to get this. Even if you happen to subscribe to the Thor crossover, they threw in the extra alpha whatever.
Right.
That you're never going to get. And I think it's a real problem for this model of, like, I get crossovers and guest appearance, and that's fine and everything. But when you're locked into these kind of trade size stories, you're taking a big detour on this for stories that don't really work. Now, they do give you a blurb. And now we're Donny Cates, Martin Cicchello, and Matt Wilson. Like, a great team, like, solid, but, you know, it reads the setup of the 2 issues you missed, or the 1, or whatever. And then it gets it, but it's really hollow. And it doesn't read very well at all. And this is now Hulk fighting Thor. A natural, again, a kind of a big punch-up thing with a Tony Stark that appears kind of young. I guess it's that dimension's Tony Stark. And he has commanded some classic space tech repurposed to fight the Hulk and everything. But I think that Ryan Ottley was a little bit better suited, because for my money, and I think the establishing shots are probably in those other issues, but here it's a lot more close-ups. And I feel like, because some of us didn't read those other issues, a couple of nice, big, like, what does this thing that he's fighting in look like? You know, you want that massive, nice spread of, like, here's all the cool armor and gewgaws and everything. But because this is chapter 2 or 3, we're in the middle of the fight already. So I don't get that kind of pretty, what's a Hulk Buster armor built out of an old Celestial look like. You know, I want that kind of dream shot. But so, this is the chapter where Hulk gets pushed to his limit and releases like an internal gamma bomb that wipes out everything. And this Thor has been taken over by Odin. So that's a conflict within the characters there. And yeah, it felt kind of like, oh, this, if I was only reading these by subscription, what a waste. Like, I'm now burned 2 issues because there's a second part and it doesn't read very well. I mean, it's cool that at the end, spoiler, Hulk and this Thor merge into Thor Hulk sort of thing. And I like all the permutations, but it just drove home that, like, how can they, offering these subscriptions is pointless unless you can also run down all the crossover. Well, and by the time you got this, it's probably too late.
Yeah.
You know, like, and if you already have a comic shop, unless you're a weirdo like me, you're probably also not subscribed. It's just like a weird way they want to capture the subscription market, but they're not selling books in that way anymore.
And they're not
I mean, shouldn't they be sending a free Marvel previews to every subscription, holder too, so they can know what else is out there? And try, I mean, I have a friend who is a little older than I am. Yes, they're people older than me, and he is buying subscriptions for his teenage son and enjoying them himself too. But he, I don't know, he must have had like 10 subscriptions, but he was, last time I talked to him, he was expressing such frustration at it, saying, like, there's no Doctor Strange title right now, he said. There's no Doctor Strange comic. How can there be no, there you is. Know, well, if you have a subscription and you had a subscription to the old title, you didn't, you're not getting this new one. He doesn't, he's not getting, I don't know what is happening for him, but he's like, it's awful. It's like the guy really needs a previews and needs to give it all up and do the unlimited instead. You're right. Marvel's not doing a good job. And how about the fact that they're ending their titles and starting up new titles all the time? So you don't know. It makes it very difficult. It's just not the scattershot try to fill the shelves of the store's model doesn't jive well with the subscription idea at all.
You know what I mean? Maybe they could. It's like you're on back to the newsstand, and you never know what issue you're going to get, and sometimes you miss issues.
Yeah, I can see that, but I feel like at the height of newsstand, there was usually, unless it was like a super hot issue or something, or some weird distribution in your area, you could, if you really were desperate, you could hit enough little drugstores or whatever to usually get them. It didn't always work. But I feel like it could. And as a kid, I ended up getting a lot of mail order subscriptions, so I never missed any issues, except when the post office would lose it or whatever. But that was pretty rare, too. And you could always call up and complain. And those weren't written with this kind of very strict, generally speaking, 5 to 6 issue arcs where it's like that chapter that you're getting. Like, there were multi-part stories and everything, but it wasn't. This stuff feels very like, okay, here's our thing. There are a few continuing threads here and there. I don't know if they could offer like a subscription where you follow the character or something. Like, I don't know how to fix it. Obviously, this, I'm sure the print subscription's a pretty minor market, but it is an issue, and it was driven home with this thing. I mean, I don't really care that much about it. This was a goof to have fun, and I like getting my beat up comic book in the mail, but it drive home. But like, if you really want to follow this, then it's still on you to go find the cross. And I don't know, I just feel like sometimes the old crossovers, and this is old man Andy, so you can just skip ahead 20 seconds.
We noticed.
I feel like the chapter segments were more substantial, and some of these really do feel like this is like a middle section of one comic, as opposed to like a chapter in an ongoing thing.
I feel like this is the difference between that Captain America, Sentinel of Liberty, and sometimes Donny Cates comics. Like, sometimes Cates tends towards the less, like, here's some fantastic art, but then, you know, there's not as much story there.
I would say in this crossover, there was too much story I'm missing. A whole chunk of stuff happened, but I guess you'd need this one for the big turn of them defeating him and having the Thor transformation. It's like they gave one piece of the story to each issue or something, but I don't know. It just was fun to look at, though. But I got to say, that's another downside to these subscriptions, folks, if you're in it. But maybe DCBS or one of the mail order subscriptions, like you say, Steve, you get the previews and can follow it. But you know, that's not my jam. I'm here to buy random comics and be dumb. And I'm all out of dumb. Wait, no, I'm all out of random comics? Anyway, I don't know how those...
You'll never be out of either. That's the wonderful thing.
You list two things and you're all out of one of them. Isn't that how that goes?
Until Andy's all out of dumb, make mine Marvel.
Wow.
Later.